friends, good evening. May I request that the no smoking sign be observed? Tonight is the second lecture by Rabbi Lamb in his two-part series on Jerusalem, the Golden. I'm substituting for Rabbi Silverstein, who is the chairman of the Education and Cultural Committee of the Center, who could not be here this evening. The first lecture, Rabbi Lamb's topic was the theology of the hiding God. Tonight, Rabbi Lamb will speak on the topic of reunited Jerusalem in halacha and Jewish philosophy. And without any further ado, I wish to present our beloved Rabbi, Dr. Norman Lamb. Our last lecture, as Mr. Green informed us in his delightfully brief introduction, dealt with the theological turning points occasioned by the founding of the State of Israel and especially the Six-Day War. We spoke of the history of the relationships between God and Israel, and we pointed, if you recall, to the two poles that are active in this relationship, that where God withdraws from the dialogue with Israel, which we called Hester Ponim, the hiding of God's face, in which Israel is abandoned to the impersonal and inexorable laws of nature and history, and the opposite, where God and Israel meet again, and that is called Nesias Ponim, the turning of the face, as expressed in the blessing Yisa Hashem Panav Elecha V'yaseim Lecha Shalom. Then we spoke of the Shoah, the Holocaust, and tried to integrate this tragic event of the loss of one-third of our people into the framework of this view of Jewish history, and along with it, of course, the founding of the State of Israel. We spoke of meaningfulness and meaninglessness. We said that, according to this view, we were emerging out of Hester Ponim that had lasted for close to 2,000 years. We had not quite achieved that great desideratum, that great goal of Nesias Ponim, of the resumption, the full resumption of the dialogue of God and Israel, the Yisa Hashem Ponov, but rather that we were in a transitional state, which the Talmud refers to as a dream state, b'chalom adaber bo, where there's the beginning of a dialogue, where God and man have begun to meet but have not quite concluded the dialogue, not quite precipitated the dialogue and carried it off, and that we try to identify it as a state of yo'er Hashem panav elecha, a feeling of luminousness as once again, Israel and God begin the relationship that had been so abruptly interrupted almost 1900 years ago. Well, that was a rather up in the clouds discussion, although to my mind quite important. Tonight, we're going to become a little more practical in our considerations. If the events of our lifetime have meaning, then this meaning must be reflected, as everything is in Judaism, in the halacha, in Jewish law, which deals ultimately with the gut issues of man and of Israel. These new situations of world Jewry, the new orientations in Jewish history, have therefore certain halachic consequences, and they confront us with a new challenge that is fascinating and frightful all at the same time. Most American Jews, I dare say most of us here tonight, are totally unaware of an incipient movement in the State of Israel that is still unorganized, but is real and is even sensational, I have the feeling, friends, that our whole discussion this evening is going to sound a bit surrealistic. That after all is said and done, you're going to have the feeling that you were somehow put through a Chagall painting, where everything seems to be suspended in midair with a feeling of unreality about it. Maybe even shock, mostly disbelief. I know, I confess before I begin, I am biting off more than I can chew. I'd like to ask you in advance to try a little experiment with me, and that is that after the lecture is done, to try to recollect what were your unstudied reactions to the whole thesis I am presenting to you. Is it going to be one of anger, dismay, incredulity, dismissing the whole thing with an annoyed wave of the hand? Or are you going to feel as if suddenly there was released from within you a kind of romantic vision that had long been repressed? Because on the answer to this question it may be quite revealing about yourself and tell you something about yourself as well as about the lecture. Whatever it is, I can promise you that the issues will eventually come to public attention, and it therefore is worth learning something about them right now. I can also promise you that certain aspects of these new problems created by the great victory this past June are very disturbing, psychologically, culturally, politically, and halakhically. So much so that you're going to begin to sympathize with that couple in the folklore of our people, about whom it is told that this couple of yeshivniks, of farmers, were caught in a quandary because the mister had just bought a new cow and had spent all his money on the cow plus feed plus buying some seed to plant. Every last penny was spent. Upon which his wife turned to him and tearfully said, "Now what's going to happen? You put all that money into a cow and into seed and into planting. What happens if Mashiach is going to come tomorrow? The whole investment is lost." Whereupon he said to her, consolingly, "Don't worry." He says, "We survived the Pharaoh, we survived the Haman, we survived an Antiochus, we'll survive Mashiach too." We're up to that point where we're going to confront messianic problems, and hopefully we're all going to survive it, Mashiach included. What I hope to discuss tonight, if the evening is long enough and you're patient enough, is the controversy over our entry when we visit Israel onto the Temple Mount, the problem of rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, in our own days, the question of the resumption of sacrifices, not in the distant future, but this year, Pesach, or at the latest next year, Pesach. And then finally, the meaning of the whole institution of Karbanos, or sacrifices. Those of us who visited in Israel since this past June know that when we visit the Kotel Ma'arovi, the Western Wall, which used to be called the Wailing Wall, and as we walk south, you know, the Western Wall is west. It's the first great thing we've learned tonight. As we walk right or south, there is an entrance onto the Temple Mount, the little hill on which the two mosques now stand and where the Beis HaMikdash once stood. And there are troops guarding that entrance. And there is also a big sign over it in Ivrit, I believe in English too, I'm not sure, I seem to forget, a sign by the chief rabbinate warning Jews that it is forbidden, according to Jewish law, to enter beyond that point on the Temple Mount. You may also be aware of the fact that that sign is the subject of considerable controversy. That the civilian chief rabbinate, the chief rabbinate of Israel, Rabbi Zunterman and Nissim, believe that one ought not to enter the Temple Mount, but the military chief rabbinate, under Rabbi Goren, believes that it's quite all right under certain conditions. As a matter of fact, he did so with a number of his troops, and they davened mincha on the Har HaBayis on the Temple Mount. Now, what is this all about? According to the Torah, It is forbidden for a tummy, a person who had contracted one of several kinds of impurity, it is forbidden for a tummy to enter certain sacred places. Sacred places means places like Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, the courtyard of the temple on the Temple Mount, and the place of the temple of the Beis HaMikdash itself. The various prohibitions depending upon the nature of the tumah or the impurity that one had contracted. The question, therefore, is, on that Temple Mount, where was the temple? How far does it extend? The chief rabbinate is undecided. And therefore, they say, because we're not quite sure, don't go on it altogether. Rabbi Gorin believes that he knows where the temple was by the literature we have. He knows, therefore, what is out of bounds and where one may walk if he conducts himself in this certain manner. That is why, shortly after the conquest of the Har HaBayis, the word Har HaBayis literally means the mountain of the house. By the word house, we mean Beis HaMikdash, the temple, the sanctuary. Therefore, Har HaBayis means the Temple Mount. Shortly after the conquest of Jerusalem, Rabbi Gorin took his people. They went to the mikveh. They immersed themselves in the pool according to the law, purifying themselves of the tumah. They removed their shoes. We'll see later why. And they went on to the mountain, and there they performed a mincha service. Immediately, two thorny problems were raised. For Orthodox Jews, there is a halachic question. If you or I go to Israel, may we or may we not go on to the Temple Mount? Now, this is more than just a tourist problem, because tourist problems are of supreme lack of interest to me. It is a halachic problem. May we go on to the place about which we have prayed all our lives? May we go there and pray there? For the government of Israel, this presented a more ticklish problem. If Jews were going to go and pray on the Temple Mount, this would immediately incense the Arabs. And Arabs are incensed even if you do nothing. But this would give them more of an excuse in the eyes of world opinion, whose fickleness we have been acquainted with for some time. And since the government of Israel, God knows, has enough problems with public relations, they did not want to provoke any kind of charge that we were denying the rights, the religious rights of minorities. Therefore, the government forbade Rabbi Gorin to hold a second service on that spot. As a result, we have the following paradoxical results. Muslims can come and go as they please on a Har HaBayis, which is now in sovereign Jewish hands. Curiosity seekers, Jewish tourists, Jewish picnickers, can come and go as they please because they're not infringing on the religious rights of the Muslims. But if a religious Jew should want to go with the tourists and with the Muslim and there daven mincha, he is forbidden. Obviously, this is an untenable situation from every and any point of view, and one which will sooner or later have to be solved. But this leads us into the history of the whole problem. For Christians, the Temple Mount is one of many holy places. For Christianity, it is important because that is where Jesus ate his last Korban Pesach, the Paschal Lamb. You know the Paschal Lamb must be eaten only in Yerushalayim. And that is the place where he was arrested and judged. For Muslims, it is holy because of their legend that that is where Muhammad came with his magic horse, and from the Temple Mount, they ascended into heaven. For the Muslims, it is not the major holy place. It is third in order, after Mecca and Medina. For both Muslims and Christians, therefore, it is a derivative in its holiness from Judaism. It is only because the Beis HaMikdash was there that both Christianity and Islam have any attribution of holiness to this particular spot. For us, of course, it is the holiest place of all. It is a place where, according to Jewish tradition, Abraham offered up his son Isaac, although he ultimately did not sacrifice him, but Spiritually and psychologically, he did. It was the Akedah. Har HaMoriah is the Har HaBayis. It is the place where both temples stood and where Jews worshipped from the days of David to the days of Bar Kokhba, with several interruptions because of military reasons. For over 1,100 years, Jews never stopped praying for the privilege of praying on the Har HaBayis. We say it every day. We never stopped planning for it. After the Muslim conquest of Jerusalem, with Jewish help, incidentally, Jews built a synagogue on the Har HaBayis with Muslim help. Then when the Muslim built their mosques, they still permitted Jews to worship in the synagogue. Only in the year 1099, when Christian crusaders destroyed the Jewish community of Jerusalem, were we banished from the Har HaBayis, and this was kept up even after the Muslims came back. We have documents from the middle of the 16th century which tell us that although there was no longer a synagogue on the Har HaBayis, Jews would climb on the rooftops of the houses on the Temple Mount, and there would pray facing north, because the only place they were permitted to walk is on the southern end of the Har HaBayis. You'll see later what I mean. I have diagrams for you. They faced east, and there they prayed. At the end of the 16th century, Muslim fanatics forbade Jews from any kind of entry to the Har HaBayis, and the closest that Jews could come was outside the walls of the Temple Mount, and only one wall remained, and that was the western wall, the Kosa Maravi. So the whole importance of the Kosa Maravi really dates from that time, from the time that Jews were not permitted to go on to the Har HaBayis. Now, what is the immediate problem? After this lecture is over, at least maybe all of us will know the Chumash a little better when we read these parts these coming weeks. This is a very rough sketch, obviously it's not accurate, of what the Torah considers the Mishkan. In other words, when Israel traveled through the desert, you recall there were three camps. There was an outer camp, inside that another camp, inside that a third camp. And the more important was the innermost. The outside one, let's take the number ones, was called Machane Yisrael, the camp of Israel. Then came the inside camp, Machane Leviya, the camp of the Levites. The inside one was called Machane Shechina, the camp of the divine presence. So you had the three camps in ascending order as we go inward. The camp of Israel, the camp of the Levites, the camp of the Shechina, or the divine presence. Now, this was the days of the tabernacle. When Jews finally came to Jerusalem, and Jerusalem was set as our capital city and as our holy city, there again were three distinct factions, three distinct areas, equivalent to these. And that is, the Machane Yisrael, what originally was the camp of Israel, was now called Yerushalayim Shebein HaChomot, Jerusalem within the walls. When you walk within the old city of Jerusalem, that old city is equivalent to Machane Yisrael. Then the Har HaBayis, the Temple Mount, is equivalent to Machane Leviya, the Levite. The place of the temple itself, that is Machane Shechina, the place of the divine presence. What is the difference in law? The difference is this. All of them are holy, with the greater holiness accruing to which part? The center. This is most holy, this is less holy, this less holy. Therefore, those with a severe kind of tumah or impurity may not come here, but with lesser kinds may come in. And you go up the line as you come in. Only those who are completely tahor, who have no uncleanliness — this is not to be taken, please, in a hygienic term. This is purely in a ritual term. It doesn't mean if you take a shower you can walk into the Beis HaMikdash. It means certain types of ritual impurity, which I'll explain in a moment. Now, they are as follows. A leper, or I'm using the term loosely, it really isn't leprosy. My physician friends inform me it's a certain kind of other condition not related to leprosy. But the Metzora, at any rate, was regarded as Tame. He may not come in the days of Moses even to Machane Yisrael. He was Chutz La Machane, outside the camp. Therefore, in the days when Jerusalem was built, the leper was not permitted to come into the walled city. He was kept outside the walled city in King David Hotel and the King's Hotel. Couldn't come into the walled city. See, that's how we discriminated against our Mitzorayim. Then, those who suffered from certain kinds of running issue, let's say the tumah, the impurity that accrues to a woman who is a nida in the menstrual state, or to a man who had certain kinds of running issue, and who had not yet gone to the mikveh and purified himself, man or woman, may come into the outer area, which means to Jerusalem itself, the walled city, but may not come onto the Har Habayis, onto the Temple Mount. May not come to the Temple Mount. If one did not have this impurity, but let's say he had another impurity, that he had come into contact with a dead body, tumas meis, under the same roof with a dead body, and had not purified himself, or a non-Jew, may come here, may not come on into the Beis HaMikdash itself. As a matter of fact, right here, on the Temple Mount, right before the entrance to the temple, there were two signs in temple days, one in Latin and one in Greek, warning Gentiles that they may proceed no further. We still have the Greek sign today. It's in the Museum of Constantinople. So beyond this point, someone who was tamei because of contact with a corpse or a Gentile could not enter into the Mekom HaMikdash itself. Now, the temple itself had certain areas. In one place, only Israelites could enter who were tahor. Another one, only Israelites who were sacrificing. The third, only the Kohanim. The innermost core of the temple was called the Kodesh HaKodashim, or the inner sanctum. There, even a Kohen or a priest could not enter. Only who? Only the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, and only once a year. When? On Yom Kippur. Now, the situation today... The situation today is as follows. This is approximately, if you'll excuse the severe geometry of it, this is what the Temple Mount looks like today. Here is east, south, west, north. This is the Temple Mount walled in. This is the Wailing Wall, the Kotel HaMaravi, which those of us who were there remember. The entrance that I spoke of before is about over here. This is the big mosque, the golden kippah, the golden, the golden dome, the Mosque of Omar. This is the smaller mosque called Al-Aqsa. Now, this Mosque of Omar we believe to be on the spot of the temple itself, with this block place here signifying the Holy of Holies, the holiest place of the temple, which was northwest of the Temple Mount. Our problem is the shaded area. This, let us assume, is the court of the temple and the temple. The question is, may we go on to this specific area? Let me explain for a moment. Can we ever go on to this area today? Why? Why not? Because to go into the innermost area, you can't if you're a tamei meis, if you are impure because of contact with a corpse. For reasons we can't go into, all Jews today are considered becheskas tamei meisim, a presumption that we are so impure. In order to purify ourselves, we have to go through a ritual which is unavailable today, that of Parah Aduma, the red heifer. So there is no solution at present for going into this area, except to conquer it, which our boys did this past June. However, here we can go. What is the only problem? That we may be impure even from many, many years ago because of some physical impurity, nida or zav. Then we have a solution, do we not? What is the solution? Mikveh. So therefore, if I go to the mikveh, I may go into this particular area. That is precisely our problem. But the problem is really much more interesting than that. why may I not go into this area? Because I am Tomei, yes? So what? Is this area holy? Is it? Why? Why is it holy? Because that is where the temple is. Is the temple there? The Mosque of Omar is there. There's no temple there. The problem is this. The problem is, after the destruction of the temple in the year 70, did the sanctity that adheres to this particular spot, did that sanctity vanish with the temple?
No.
Or did it survive the temple? So you have all kinds of opinions. Well, it so happens that the unanimous opinion I heard is correct, but not according to everyone. Actually, it's an old controversy beginning from Tanaitic days. The question is expressed as follows. Kedusha Rishona, Kiddusha L'Shata, V'Kiddusha L'Atid Lavo, or Lo Kiddusha L'Atid Lavo? Which means, when this area was sanctified the first time, through whom? Who first sanctified this area? Solomon, when he built the temple. Was that sanctification, that holiness, was it only for that time as long as the building survives? Or was it forever? So there are some who say one way and some who say the other way. We're dealing with the Jewish problem, friends. And this controversy continues. The nub of a problem, I was going to use a word that would identify me as a Republican, so I want the nitty-gritty of the problem. The real collision, the focus of the problem, comes about between Maimonides, the Rambam, and his great controversialist in halacha, namely the Ravad, by Abraham ibn Daud. Maimonides maintains Kedusha Rishona Kitchola Shato Vekitchola Sidlavo, that once he sanctified it, Solomon, it remains eternally holy, building or no building, temple or no temple. The temple may have vanished architecturally, but the Kedusha, the sanctity, remains. The Ravad, on the other hand, maintains that once the temple was destroyed, there is no longer any Kedusha. Therefore, may a person who is Tomei tread on this area? Yes. Even that's not too clear. When Ravad says that there is no longer a sanctity, we don't know if he means that there is no sanctity insofar as being punished for it. But to begin with, you may not. Or whether there is entirely no sanctity. But that's a secondary problem. However, as you so clearly indicated quite intuitively, whom do we decide with, Rambam or Ravid? Is it holy or is it not holy? Today? It is. It is. We agree with the Rambam. Not always, but in this case. We agree with the Rambam. And therefore, this place, this area, remains kadosh, and no one who is Tamei may enter it. Yet we know, historically, that despite the fact that Jews, the majority of Jews, accepted the continuing sanctity of this area, there was a synagogue on this area in the shaded part. Not only was there a synagogue there, but Maimonides, the Rambam himself, wrote a letter, which we still have, I believe, in which he writes of visiting the Holy Land, and he speaks of worshiping Bebayis HaGadol VaHaKadosh, in the great and holy house, which can mean only one thing, a synagogue on the Har HaBayis itself. So that Maimonides, who declares the sanctity of this hill, of the Temple Mount, himself worshipped there. Of course, it means that he did it after Tvila, after immersing in the mikveh, and with proper precautions. What are those precautions? Let me read to you from Maimonides himself, the laws of the temple. It is a positive commandment to reverence the sanctuary. This is the law of Mora HaMikdash. If you consider this the place of the sanctuary or the temple, then you have to act with a certain reverence. And reverence means not only not to talk during davening. It includes that. For it is said, Es Mikdashai Tiro, you shall reverence my sanctuary. This does not bid you, says Maimonides. This does not mean that you have to be afraid of the sanctuary itself, of brick and mortar, but him who commanded that we reverence it. When we express reverence for the sanctuary, what are we in effect doing? We are acting out our reverence for the Rabbono Shel Olam, whose spirit is therein. What does this imply? That one may not enter the Temple Mount with his staff. In other words, as if you're treading on it with your cane. Or with sandals on his feet. You must do what? Remove your shoes. Or in his undergarment. You can't go in with without a shirt on. Or with dust on one's feet. One must wash his feet before going on it. Or with coins exposed, with money. You can keep it in your pocket, but you can't keep your wallet, let's say, hanging on the outside, or a purse for that matter. Nor may you go, if you want to go from here to here, you may not cut across using the Har HaBayis as a shortcut. Incidentally, the same holds true for a synagogue. If it's raining and you want to enter a synagogue through one door and go out through the other because you want to spare yourself space or a length of journey, it is forbidden with a synagogue derivatively from the sanctuary itself. Further, when you leave the Har HaBayis, you may not turn your back on it, but you must walk backwards as a sign of respect. And one may not act in a frivolous manner at any time in this area, nor may one sit down in any part of this area of the Azara. So here are the precautions to which I referred and which are called Mora Mikdash, the reverence for the sanctuary. Therefore, all contemporary rabbis agree with Maimonides that it is forbidden to enter this area in a state of tumah. Theoretically, we all permit going into the shaded area if there were, what two conditions now? Tvila, the immersion, yes, mikvah, and second, acting in a reverent manner, mora mikdash. The problem is where? The problem is this picture correct or isn't it? Because when the Muslims built that mosque 400 years ago, they changed the topography of the mountain. And we are not quite sure of how far the temple extended and how far it did not extend. If this picture is correct, then there's no problem. The chief rabbis say we don't know. Therefore, this may very well be the place where the temple was, or close to it. Hence, we do not enter. Rabbi Goren used a yardstick. Following Maimonides' prescriptions, he believes clearly that this place is permitted. Therefore, if one purifies himself or herself, if one takes off one's shoes and acts properly, you may enter that particular area. What ought we do? My advice is to wait until the situation is clarified. The Beis HaMikdash has meant very much to us in Jewish tradition. And I don't believe we ought to enter simply to satisfy our own whim or our own tourist curiosity. Tourist curiosity still must be second to something much more important, namely our loyalty to Torah and our memory of the greatness of the glory of the Beis HaMikdash. Now from this we go to a fascinating problem. For the first time in centuries, Jews have Jerusalem. It is ours, all of it. Should we rebuild the Beis HaMikdash? We speak so often in our prayers asking God to bring us back to the rebuilt third temple. Do we have the right, not only the right, do we have the obligation to do it? Now that, I like your positive thinking. But let me acquaint you with a number of problems. Tonight's problem night with us. First is the diplomatic problem. What are you going to do with these two places? You can't just take the Mosque of Omer and move it off. Obviously, this is a holy place for the Muslims, and we can't get rid of it. Of course, the problem was put in somewhat different terms by Dr. Yisrael Eldad, formerly Dr. Yisrael Shub, who used to be one of the commanders of the Stern Gang, and today has written a very superb commentary on the Chumash. He says, for instance, if there was an earthquake, and the earthquake tumbled off all buildings off the Har HaBayis, then we are confronted with a problem. Shall we build the Beis HaMikdash there or not? Now, of course, that sounds a little bit frivolous. But the way military, political, diplomatic problems have a tendency to change so quickly with so many rapid vicissitudes in our own time, one cannot discount the possibility of an earthquake. Nevertheless, certainly it would be the most extravagant idea for any Israeli government or people or citizen or individual to remove it forcibly. But assume for argument's sake that we discover that the Beis HaMikdash was here. Could we build our Beis HaMikdash in that area if this was really the place of the Beis HaMikdash? After all, this coming Shabbos we shall read in the Torah, V'yasu li mikdash v'shachanti b'socham. It is one of the 613 commandments we must build a temple. Therefore, the question is not, may we do it, but also, must we do it? First, there's an apparently interesting halachic roadblock. One of our great scholars, the Chinuch of medieval Spain, in formulating the commandment to build a temple, says the following. Mitzvah tzadikei, livnos bayis l'shem Hashem, it is a commandment to build a house for God. V'noheges mitzvozo bizman sherov Yisrael al admasan. But this commandment is relevant only when most of the Jewish people live in Palestine. Do most of the Jewish people live in Palestine today?
No.
No. We shouldn't be so proud when we say that. There are only about 13-15% of all Jews who today live in the Holy Land. This would apparently make it impossible for us even to consider the problem. However, there was a great scholar of a couple generations ago by the name of Rabbi Yeshua Kutna who asked a very simple question. We know from history that when Ezra, you remember Ezra and Nehemiah? When Ezra came back from Babylon, what was his mission? To rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. At that time, most Jews did not go with him. Most Jews then were Zionists. They got together and sent a third Jew to Palestine. Therefore, when Ezra came from Babel to Palestine, there were no more than 40,000 Jews in the Holy Land at that time. The overwhelming majority were in Babylon, in Mesopotamia. Yet Ezra proceeded to rebuild the temple. By what right? Most of the Jews were not in Israel then. And the answer he gives is a fascinating one. He says, Rov Yisrael al admasan, the qualification that most Jews have to be in Israel means that those Jews who can go to Israel and go there have a vote, as it were. But those Jews who can go there and don't go there forfeit their rights, and these rights are picked up by those who did go. That if you or I have the possibility of going to Eretz Yisrael and we don't, then we have relinquished our right to be considered the majority to those Jews who did go on Aliyah or their parents or grandparents did. Therefore, in Ezra's day, the other Jews could go. They didn't go. Therefore, their vote, as it were, their proxy, was taken up by Ezra and his people. Therefore, they constituted the majority. Today, can American Jews go to Palestine? To Palestine. I'll never forgive the British. Can we go to the state of Israel if we're to Eretz Yisrael, if we should so wish? Not only can we should. And we don't, at least not yet. Therefore, if we don't go, we have forfeited our rights, and the proxy has now been given to whom? To the Israelis. Therefore, they constitute the majority. Legally, it is considered Rov Yisrael al admasan, as it was during Ezra's days. Of course, there's a problem with Russian Jews. You have 3 million Russian Jews who can't go. And how many Jews are in Israel today, approximately? About 2 million. However, when you consider that they pick up our 5.5 million votes, as it were, because we have forfeited our chance, therefore they still remain a majority, and the problem is back where we started from. Can we build a Beis HaMikdash in our days? Four opinions present themselves. Briefly, they are as follows. Number one, the Babylonian Talmud and Maimonides maintain that in the order of their eschatology is a big word that means acharis hayamim, which means the end of days, the sequence of redemption, when history will come to its climax for Israel and for the world. In their eschatology, our Talmud, our Gemara, the Babylonian, and Maimonides maintain that first Mashiach will come, first Messiah, and then the Beis HaMikdash will be built. Rashi and the Tosafos, composed mostly by his family, maintain that the third temple will appear miraculously out of heaven. The third opinion is the Jerusalem Talmud, which maintains that first Jews will build the temple, and then the Messiah will come. And the fourth opinion is a very little known one, but a fascinating one. The Medrash Talpios says as follows. The third temple will be built not by Mashiach, won't come down from heaven, it won't be built by Jews, it will be built by Esav, by the Goyim. Because, says the Medrash, this will be the way, after all, whose son was Esav? Whose son was Esau? Isaac. Esau, despite the fact that he's an Esav, but he has in him something from his father. He has a spiritual dimension that he cannot banish from his life, even if he should want to. And in the end of days, says the Medrash, Esau will redeem that spiritual gestalt, that spiritual ego within him, by being the one to build the Beis HaMikdash for Israel to bring peace to the entire world. In other words, according to the Medrash Talpios, the UN under Ud Tant will build the Beis HaMikdash. As soon as it's arranged for a ceasefire in Vietnam. Now let's analyze these opinions. According to the Babylonian Talmud of Maimonides, can we proceed to build a temple today? Can we? No. Because according to him, who must come first? Mashiach. Is Mashiach here? Not latest reports, therefore Mashiach isn't here. In other words, what is the Gemara, what does the Babylonian Talmud of Maimonides do? They push the rebuilding of the temple to the remote future, to eschatological times beyond the coming of Mashiach. According to Rashi and Tosfos, can we build a temple? No, why? Because according to them, it comes out of heaven. It hasn't come out of heaven yet. Although this opinion is not accepted by everyone, others say that it's based upon a misreading of a Medrash, and it's even more difficult for another reason. If according to them, the temple will appear by itself, as it were, how can we say that it's one of the 613 commandments to build a temple? We have a principle, Ein Somchan al Hanes. A Jew must never rely upon a miracle. If we can't rely upon a miracle, we must build it. How can they then say that it will appear of itself, as it were? According to the Medrash Talpios, that the Goyim will build it, well, let them, but frankly, our recent experience with the UN means that it may take a little too long. Finally, according to the Jerusalem Talmud, can we proceed to build the temple? Yes, by all means. It is the only source. Therefore, how many sources maintain we can do so today? One. How many are against it?
Three.
So when you combine the majority opinions, plus the somewhat trivial diplomatic obstacles, in the form of one big golden dome and one small silver one, the problem is somewhat out of our reach today. So my dear friends, you may sigh a sigh of relief. We're not going to go on a building fund campaign tonight. No calling of cars to get your pledges for the third Beis HaMikdash, because if we do it, we're still not sure. You must have heard the story about the shul in the Bronx, into which thieves broke into it, into the safe at night, and they stole $1.5 million worth of pledges. So we're not going to ask you for your pledges. Please be patient. But I'd like to go with you to something a bit different. Yes, Beis HaMikdash built by us. Wait a while. We all hope we're going to see it in our lifetimes. Who knows, we may. How many of us would have believed 20 years ago that we would be the Balabatim of Yerushalayim and we would visit the Kol Samaravi? This was beyond our wildest dreams. What is the importance of the Beis HaMikdash to us? We constantly speak of it in our prayers. So forgetting the halachic and the political difficulties, because these juridical and diplomatic situations can change very quickly, What does it mean to us, and what are the consequences of this age-old and contemporary hope for the Beis HaMikdash? In order to understand it, let's try to understand something else. There are two poles, two moments in Jewish thought, or if you will, there are two forms that are taken by what we call Kedusha, holiness or sanctity. There are two kinds of holiness. There is Kedushas HaMakom and Kedushas HaZman. Each holiness can be identified as a holiness of place or space or object within space, or the holiness of Zman, of time. An example. What are some examples of the holiness of Makom, Kedushas HaMakom? A synagogue. Are you allowed to smoke in a synagogue? No. Are you allowed to eat in a synagogue? No. Are you allowed to talk in a synagogue? Yes, not during services. In other words, by virtue of its Kedusha, certain rules apply. Or a Sefer Torah. You have to stand for it. You can't touch it with your fingers. That's why we use a pointer. It's an object, and it has certain kind of sanctity. Much better. Eretz Yisrael, is it holy? Yes, the holiness of time or place. Place. Jerusalem, the holiness of place. The Har HaBayis, the holiness of place. The Beis HaMikdash, the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Increasingly, the Gemara and Mishnah says there are Esa Kedusha, saying there are 10 levels of Kedusha, of sanctity that adheres to place. Is that all the Kedusha there is? No. There is also a Kedusha that refers to time. Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkot. What is the prime example of holiness of time? Shabbos. How do you know that it's the prime one? It's the first one mentioned in the Torah. When the Torah says what? Vayakadesh also. God himself sanctified this time. So we have Kedushas HaMakom and Kedushas HaZman. The holiness of place and the holiness of time. Now let me ask you, friends, which is more important? The holiness of time or the holiness of place? And the answer is unquestionably the holiness of Zman, of time. For a very simple balabatisha logical reason. That a Jew can avoid a holy place for, if he lives for 120 years, he can manage to avoid a holy place. Never to go to Eretz Yisrael, never to come into a synagogue, never to be within the vicinity of a Sefer Torah, and still be a good Jew, at least partially. But he can manage to avoid any confrontation with that Kedusha, with that sanctity that is described in terms of place. Can a Jew avoid confronting the holiness that applies to time? Why? How long does it take him once he's 7 days old, he already has confronted Kedushas HaZman. For this reason, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch explains that circumcision takes place on the eighth day. Because on the eighth day means that this child had to experience at least one experience of Kedusha. At least one day, if he's 8 days old, at least one day had to be Shabbos. So at least one day of experience with Kedusha. If you made it on 7 days or on 6 days, he might have avoided the experience of Kedusha. If that is the case, he's not ready for Bris Milah. To come into the covenant of Israel, he had to have one experience or confrontation with sanctity. So that Professor Heschel is right when in his superb book on the Sabbath, he says that the Shabbat for the Jew is a cathedral in time. This cathedral in time, Kedushas HaZman, enabled us to survive the Golus. Because even though we were banished from Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim and the Har HaBayis and the Beis HaMikdash, the Jew took his Kedusha with him. He had his Shabbos. He had his Yontif. And therefore, our experience of Kedusha went with us to all corners of the world. Or Professor Baron is right when he makes a very interesting observation. Take all our festivals, the major festivals. What are they? The three major festivals, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot. If you look at them carefully, each of them has a double explanation. On the one hand, they refer to natural agricultural events. Pesach is which I'm not a farmer, so I always get confused. Pesach is which harvest? Wheat. Shavuos is barley. And Sukkot is? All right. So I'm not a farmer. But yes, Shavuos is wheat, Ksir Chitim. Barley is Pesach, and Shavuos? Sukkot. And anyway, you have to trust me, friends. I can't help it. Each of them is a harvest festival. Each of them is a harvest festival. Yet, in addition to this natural, geographical, agricultural explanation, which the Torah speaks of, there is another explanation. What is it? A historical one. A time-centered explanation. Such as Pesach is Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Exodus. Sukkot is the traveling in the desert. Shavuos is Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah. Which do we emphasize in our liturgy and our prayers? We emphasize the time, history. We prefer history over geography, events over agriculture, time over space, Kedushas Hazman over Kedushas HaMakom. Furthermore, the emphasis on Makom, on space, on objects, on inanimate objects, leads to paganization. It means that, in a manner of speaking, we may be led astray to the point where we begin to invest Kedusha with magical qualities, where we imagine if a thing is Kadosh, then somehow it has miraculous powers that exist in it naturally, and that I can sort of work magic with these powers. I have to stand in awe of it. When, as a matter of fact, does any object ever have any self-contained holiness in Judaism? I spoke about this last Shabbos. When I spoke of fundamentalism, those of you who were there and those of you who were awake and those of you who remember, I've about eliminated everybody. But this is a fundamentalist magical idea that an object possesses some kind of special spirit called Kedusha. It's not so. When the Jew says that there's Kedusha Samakam, what does he mean? That I, a human being or some other human being, by virtue of certain acts of conscience and consciousness, have given Kedusha to this place. Why is this place holy? Because David envisioned it and Solomon sanctified it. Why is a synagogue holy? Not because Jews paid for it, but because Jews davened in it. Why is a Sefer Torah holy? Because a scribe who's a God-fearing man had kavana of the name of God when he wrote it. So the Kedusha is given to it. And if the scribe who wrote it was discovered to be a heretic, he didn't believe, or if Solomon didn't have the right intentions, or if the people who daven in the synagogue don't daven properly according to the din, the Kedusha vanishes. It no longer exists. But if we're going to emphasize Kedushas HaMakom, we may be led astray to the point where we attribute certain magical inherent qualities for the object. So what have I tried to say so far? That between the two, Kedushas Hazman, Kedushas HaMakom, which is greater? Kedushas Hazman. Nevertheless, with all due respect to the superiority of the holiness of time, it would be wrong for us to dismiss the Kedushas HaMakom completely. The Beis HaMikdash plays a central role in Jewish life. The Avodah and the Yom Kippur, the major part of Yom Kippur is what? It is a relation of the Avodah, the service in the Beis HaMikdash. Tisha B'Av and the fast refer to what? The Beis HaMikdash. As a matter of fact, the Seder on Pesach celebrates what? The bringing of a sacrifice where? Where? In Jerusalem. When Reform broke with the Jewish tradition, its first act of breaking was when it abandoned the hope of rebuilding the temple. Incidentally, do we call the Jewish center a temple? What do we call it? A synagogue. A center, a synagogue. What does a synagogue mean? It's a Greek word which means a gathering place. Synagoga is a gathering place. A base, Hebrew? Base of Knesset, a gathering place. We do not call it a temple. Reform do call it a temple. Why? Because the Reform said we have abandoned the temple in Jerusalem. Wherever we're going to build our place for Gottesdienst, for service, that is the temple. We Orthodox Jews said, no, never, not in a million years. Here's where we pray, here's where we gather. Only one temple. That temple over here in Jerusalem. So the fact that we do not call our synagogues temples but synagogues implies our hope for the rebuilding of the temple. When Reform calls it a temple, it is a sign that they have long abandoned this hope. Do Jews need Kedushas HaMakom? Obviously we do. The great emotional arousal that took place in June, where did it take place? At what spot? Right over here, at the Western Wall. Somehow the place, the stones, are these stones magical stones? Are we that naive and superstitious? Of course not. But when you stand in front of the Kotel Ma'arovi, you feel as if all of history is on your shoulders, as if somehow you're in alignment with your great-great-great-great-grandfather whom you never knew and never knew you. But somehow as if you have two wires with a great deal of voltage and a spark jumps over them. And at that place, at that moment, you feel that you have leaped over the ages, and you're back in the times of the Kohen Gadol, and you have closed the cycle of Jewish history. There is a psychological need for a place that is sanctified by generations. Frankly, a complete abandonment of Kedushas HaMakom is, to my mind, a Golus syndrome. It's a sign of our exilehood. The exile is a man who has lost the sense of makom, of place. An exile, an abandonment of the Beis HaMikdash, is the concomitant of homelessness, of rootlessness, of alienation, of the eternally wandering Jew who doesn't have his place. If I haven't got a place that I can call my own, if I always wonder, do I want to eventually get back to Eretz Israel or not, I'm a Golus Jew, and if I wonder if Israel is only a foreign country to which I contribute, or my home, then of course I will also give up on the hope of rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash. The dream of redemption has always been tied into Zion and to the temple. Unlike Christianity, we never universalized Judaism away from people and away from place. And in the Jewish vision of the future of redemption, we are tied to the land and the temple, and after the resurrection of the land and the rebuilding of the temple, only then will come the historic redemption of the world and universal peace and justice. The Zionist theoreticians, and they were profound ones, maintained that a state of exile, of landlessness, of statelessness, is unnatural, it's abnormal for the Jew. And I agree. But I add this, that a flippant attitude to the holiness of a place, as if we are emancipated beyond such ideas, is a sign of spiritual abnormality, of spiritual sickness and disease and unnaturalness. Our return to Israel as our natural home must be followed by the return of the Shekhinah of the Divine Presence to its natural home. After V'lir Shalayim, Ircha, after we return to Jerusalem, V'sechazena einenu, V'shuvacha L'tzion Barachamim, Baruch Ata Hashem, Hamachazir Shekhinaso L'tzion. This doesn't mean we're giving up on Kedushas HaZman, heaven forbid. But it means we've got to have a balance, because paganism, as I've indicated, is taking the holiness of place and space and object to an extreme. It emphasizes the object, it becomes fetishistic, worshipping an object. The other extreme is secularism. When the secularist emphasizes time above place, when he lacks roots in any particular place, he never has a home. He is consistently and eternally alienated and rootless. What we have got to do in this historic period, it seems to me, is to emphasize the sanctity of both elements of makom and zman. And therefore we find in the Torah that both commandments are combined. Which is the highest expression of Kedushas HaMakom, of holiness of place? What is the greatest commandment of holiness of place? What is it? The Beis HaMikdash. To do what about the Beis HaMikdash? To reverence the Beis HaMikdash. What is the highest expression of the holiness of time? Time. To observe? The Torah combines them both. Es mikdashai tiro'u, v'es shapsosai tishmoru, ani Hashem. You shall reverence my sanctuary, and you shall observe my Sabbaths. I am the Lord. Therefore, let us never underestimate the hope for the actual rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash throughout the ages. And let us treat seriously the fact that we are nearer to it in time than ever before. Our state of mind, our faith, our hope, our prayers, our aspirations must precede and precipitate that glorious moment of the restoration and the beginning, really, of the third Jewish Commonwealth. Well, from here I go into the most difficult part. The part that you're really not going to be happy with. Shall we reinstitute the sacrificial system? Don't answer me. I want to work under the illusion that my audience is with me. Shall we reinstitute the sacrificial system of offering up korbanos? Now, the problem of building a temple is a bit remote. It's a bit remote. Much more real, surprisingly, I'm sure you would have initially worked it the other way around. Much more real is the question of sacrifices. As real as, when is the Chodesh Adar, this weekend? As real as 6 weeks from today, or a year and 6 weeks from today at most. You know, the very fact that we're discussing it, and even so realistically, the very fact that we're discussing it as a possibly real issue is an index of a remarkable change in our lifetimes. Do you realize that? We are here in the middle of New York discussing the possibility of bringing a korban again on the Har HaBayis. I think it's remarkable. And we've got to remember that this suddenness of this historical change, the matrix of history from which we have issued these past 6 months, means that we have remarkable opportunities. But that the greater the opportunities, the greater the dangers, and the more difficult the problems. We are an unusual generation to have been privileged even by the experience of wondering about such matters and such problems. And I might tell you that if these problems seem a bit insurmountable and a bit overwhelming, patience, friends, have patience. Have patience. I remember the story of two Jews who were studying the Talmud, the Gemara and Erevin. You probably will recognize it. It's a famous passage. The Talmud tells us that Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel had a controversy. Beis Shammai said, Tov la'adam shenivra mishalo nivra. It is better for man that he was created than that he would have, than that he would not have been created. Beis Hillel says, no. Tov la'adam shalo nivra mishanivra. It would have been better for man had he never been born than he would have been born. A real question. The rabbis tell us in the Talmud that for 2.5 years they debated the problem until finally nimnu v'gamru, they took a vote. And the conclusion of the Talmud is, Tov la'adam shelo nivra mishenivra. It would have been better for a man had he not been born than had he been born. These two youngsters were studying this passage in the Talmud, and one of them said, the decision is that it would have been better for man had he not been born than had he been born. But how many people have such luck not to be born? Maybe one in a million. Well, friends, we're that one in a million. We have been created in an era which is exciting and a thrilling juncture in Jewish history. And if we fail to feel some of that thrill and some of that excitement, then something is wrong with us. Let me start the other way. Is it possible to have a temple without sacrifices? I know some fellow in England wrote an article in one of their newspapers, in a Jewish newspaper in London, recommending a temple without a sacrifice. No, it can't be done. In the whole of the Jewish tradition, the whole importance of the temple is that that is the place where they sacrifice. So it remains an absurdity that it was thought up, incidentally, by Herzl. Herzl, as you know, was a great visionary and also not a Talmud Chacham. And he knew very little of the Jewish tradition, and he thought a temple was what they called a temple in those days. So he wanted to see the temple built again as a monument to peace. He meant well, but he didn't understand what it meant. It can be no temple without sacrifices. Can there be sacrifices without a temple? That is the question. Now, if you remember a short while ago, I told you of the opinion of Maimonides, that Kedusha Rishona, Kitcha Lashata, V'Kitcha La'asid Lavo. That once this area was sanctified, its sanctity survives the destruction of the temple. It always remains holy. What does that mean? That means that even if the Mosque of Omer is there, this area is holy, it's hallowed ground. Now, the bringing of a sacrifice in Jewish law does not depend upon the brick and the mortar of the temple. What does it depend upon? The holiness of the place. Is this place holy? Yes, therefore, we can bring sacrifices even if there is no temple. This is not something someone thought up yesterday. As a matter of fact, it goes back to shortly after the destruction of the temple in the year 70. And in that tractate of the Talmud, where the rabbis gathered to collect their oral traditions lest it be forgotten, they saw that trouble was coming politically. Amar Rabbi Yoshua, said Rabbi Joshua, Shomati, I heard a tradition, Shemakrivin Afalpi She'em Bayis, that we will be permitted and we are permitted to offer sacrifices, even if there be no temple. What is the reason? Shekdusha Rishona, Kitcho Lashata, V'Kitcho La'asid Lavo. Because the sanctity remains undefiled and it continues even without a temple. So our earliest sources tell us that we may resume the sacrificial service even before the third temple is rebuilt. Now, this problem has already been widely discussed in contemporary rabbinic literature since last June. Never before in living memory of any of us was this so real an issue. And yet, surprisingly, it goes back at least 600 years to the 14th century, and it's a fascinating story. In the 14th century in southern France, the end of the 13th, the beginning of the 14th, there was a man called Rab Ishtori Haparchi, which means the, what would we call him today? Bloom, a blossom, a pera. Rab Ishtori Haparchi. He wrote a book called Kaftor Aferach about the laws that relate to Palestine, to Israel. Here I am again. And he says that he heard a report that a great scholar who is known to us in Jewish history by the name of Rabbi Achiel Miparis, Rabbi Achiel of Paris, one of the greatest scholars of that generation, had stated in the year 1257 that he plans to go to Jerusalem and there to offer up sacrifices. You hear, in 1257, when France was under heavy Christian control, in the middle of the Christian Black Ages, he was going to go to Jerusalem and offer up a carbon. Immediately, Haparchi said to himself, but that's impossible, for two reasons. Try to follow me along in simple halachas. What is the first, well, let me see if you can guess it. What is the first problem about offering up sacrifices in 1257? Well, one we mentioned before. Tumah, are you allowed to go on this area? The Mizbeach is over here, incidentally. The altar is here. Can you enter this area? Why not? Because we are Tumah. Can we go to the mikveh and get rid of that Tumah? No, because that Tumah is Tumas Mace that comes from contact with a corpse. We can't go in there. Second, what's the second problem? Who offers up a sacrifice? A Kohen. How do we know who's a Kohen? He has to be Kohen Miyuchas, which means he has to have documents going way back to people we know from history to prove that he's a Kohen. Otherwise, he may be the sort of fellow who came and announced himself a Kohen, you know? I heard the story of a Reform rabbi who was a Kohen and attended a funeral, and someone said to him, this is a true story. He said, how can you do it? You're a Kohen. He said, I resign. Someone may have, in the course of history, nominated himself as a Kohen and accepted himself. So it can only be a Kohen Miyuchas. So Parchi didn't understand how this great thinker, this great scholar, Rabbi Chil Miparis, can try this. Then he himself answered the question. He answered it by saying as follows. Well, let me ask you a question. If Mashiach should come, how are we ever going to build a Beis HaMikdash? We're all Tomei. Probably Mashiach will be too. By all means. I mean, he's not going to be a man who's going to come flying out of the sky. Mashiach, according to the Jewish tradition, means a political leader who will be the head of the government, who will be a pious Jew, who will be a Talmid Chacham at the same time, which is conceivable. There are Talmidei Chachamim who now lead important posts in government, and He will bring the Jewish people up to a greater level, both nationally, nationalistically, and spiritually, and in the course of time, he will be proven to be the Mashiach. Nothing unnatural about it. So he probably will be Tamei too. How are we going to build it? The answer is, says HaParchi, there's a principle in law. Karbonos tzibur dochenes atzibur. A dochenes atumah. If you or I want to bring a private sacrifice, a karban yochid, and we are Tamei, we may not, until we go to the mikveh and have tahara. But if the entire congregation, if all Israel is Tamei, then the fact that we're bringing a public sacrifice on behalf of all of us means that we can do it even in a state of Tumah. So that takes care of Tumah. Makes no difference. Because since we're bringing a sacrifice for all of us, we may do it. How about the other problem? Miuchas, yichas, a yichas brief. Literally, a documentary evidence that you are a Kohen. Well, says HaParchi, there are two solutions. One of them is maybe there are such Jews. And there may be, incidentally. Because we know there are some people we know in history definitely were Kohanim, and if we can prove our descent from certain families, we can do it. More logically, says HaParchi, the requirement of Yichus was only when there were Miyuchasim. Today, no one is a Miyuchas. No one, I'm not meaning it in the Yiddish sense. No one today has that clear pedigree. Therefore, we go back legally on chazakah, which means presumption. If we have a man who's come to the center for many years, and we've always given him Kohen, and he's known as a Kohen, and his name is Kohen, or Katz, or Kagan, then we know that he is a Kohen, every indication, and the chazakah, the presumption, is enough legally to qualify him. Therefore, it says HaParchi, he indeed certainly can bring the carbon nowadays. That is the way the problem remained for a mere 500 years. Then in the 19th century, something happened. There arose a Jew by the name, and you may have heard his name, Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. You ever heard his name? He is the spiritual father of what movement? Of Mizrahi. He is the founder of religious Zionism. He undertook a great campaign to renew the sacrificial order in our days. He and the Tzvi Hirsch Chayes. And he had a vast correspondence with the greatest luminaries of Jewish life. I'll throw off a few names, you're bound to recognize one of them. Rab Nosson Adler of Frankfurt, Rabbi Akiva Eger of Posen, the Chassam Sofer of Pressburg, Rabbi Yaakov Ettlinger, the great Oroch Laner. I mean, the greatest names, those of us who know rabbinic literature, these are giants. They had a long correspondence about the immediate question is, now the time to think about reopening the sacrificial system. Well, Kalash used mostly the problems raised by HaParchi. It's a very complicated business. But this was interesting. And now you'll understand what I said before. If we're going to be able to bring a korban, we have the problem of tumah. How do we overcome the problem of tumah, impurity? Only if it's a korban tzibur, a collective one. Now, therefore, can I speak of my bringing a sin offering, let's say, because I committed a sin? That's out. So all private are out. How about a korban tumah, the daily sacrifice? No, also not. Why? For a very simple reason. A korban tzibur, a public sacrifice, cannot be donated by an individual. It has to be purchased from the machatzis ha-shekel. Those of you who were in shul yesterday, remember that we read a special parsha shkolim. That at this time of the year, we collect a half shekel from every Jew, a head tax. What was done with this? It was used for the bedek habayis, for the purchase of the sacrifices and the fixing of the temple. But the shkolim can be collected under special conditions, and one of them is that everyone must give. All Jews must be united. Now today, can you imagine all Jews getting together to give a half a shekel for karbanos? Highly unlikely. Today, if you'll find one group that will come out in favor of it, the other one will certainly say absolutely not. It's like the old story about the rabbi who wasn't feeling well and went to the hospital, and his congregation decided to send him get well feelings. And they sent him a letter, "Dear Rabbi, the board of directors wishes you a refuah shleima, a speedy recovery, by a vote of 17-6. There is bound to be disagreement, and under conditions as they quite realistically prevail in our times, we can't look forward to a Machzor HaShekel. But there is only one korban that is considered the Korban Tzibur, a public sacrifice, but is brought by individuals. And what Korban is that? Korban Pesach. A Korban Pesach can only be brought by individuals who sign up in one group before it. Therefore, a Korban Pesach is the only Korban that can be brought nowadays. And so the problem of Kalasher and Chayes a century ago was the Korban Pesach. The problem remained dormant for about 50 years. And then after the Balfour Declaration, when the Messianic fervor began to overtake our people, the problem was raised once again. When Rabbi Kalasher's book, Drisha Sion, was reissued in a critical edition with negatively critical comments by the late Chief Rabbi of Jerusalem, Ritzvi Pesach Frank of blessed memory. And again, the problem was reopened. Now, Rabbi Cook of blessed memory had a very interesting opinion. He agreed that Tumah was no problem. He agreed that Kohanim was no problem. We can get Kohanim. I'm sure that had it been done then, he would have been the Kohen Gadol, because he, by all means, was the acknowledged saint of the generation. But he said something else. The problem is we don't know the exact place of the Mizbeach, of the altar. We know that in the Second Temple, we had to have a prophet who, by prophetic spirit, identified the Makom HaMizbeach. And therefore, until we have the renewal of prophecy, or at least Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, we cannot build, we cannot restore the sacrificial order in our time. So therefore, for today, we cannot have, according to this opinion, according to Rav Cook's opinion, we cannot have the Korban unless we have the place of the Mizbeach. But it's only an opinion of a single individual. There is a great deal of talking going on at the present moment about the problem. Today, for once, thank heavens, this is one issue about which there is no polarization of the right against the left. If anything, very interestingly, the more liberal wing in Orthodoxy, this will shock you, the more liberal wing looks with greater favor upon a restoration of the Korbanos. Why? Probably because the more liberal wing is more pro-Israel and more imbued with the messianic dimension of the rebuilt state of Israel. But really, that's also irrelevant. It is fundamentally a purely halakhic question of whether this should be done or not. The first book has already been published by a rabbi in B'nai Brak who reviews the entire literature, comes to the conclusion that this Pesach, Jews ought to offer up the Korban Pesach. Well, I don't know if you have the patience, but now I'd like to discuss one last thing. I know I've been keeping you long. If anyone has to leave, please feel free. But now I'd like to discuss the meaning of all this. We've discussed the halachic problem. Should we have or should we not have a resumption of the sacrificial order? But that problem has really been with us all the time, hasn't it? Hasn't it been with us? Haven't we sometimes been troubled by the fact that in our prayers we refer to the sacrifices? Why, every Shabbos we daven Musaf. And the Musaf prayer on Shabbos is a prayer for bringing a sacrifice. The Musaf prayer on Rosh Chodesh and on the holidays speaks of the resumption of the sacrificial order. We have a Seder on Pesach. What is a Seder on Pesach? It is a celebration of the Korban Pesach, and you can't avoid it. Now it's a more immediate, practical problem. But whether it's a liturgical or a practical problem, a problem of prayer and meaning what we say, or something more immediate, it requires explanation. That is what I would like to do. But I'd like to remind you that in Judaism, the practice of a mitzvah, whether to bring a korban or to pray for it, remains unconditioned and unmodified by any reasons we may attribute to it. The commitment in our faith precedes and is more important than the understanding and the intellectual assent. This is the principle of na'aseh v'nishma. Not that first we shall do, then we shall understand. But we shall do whether we understand or not, but we'd like to understand. Now, in the history of our people, sacrifices have been attacked for a long time. For instance, Christianity tried to do away with animals. No, of course they did. It was after the destruction of the temple. But they spoke ill of the sacrificial order, and they substituted the sacrifice of Jesus, so-called, for animal sacrifices. The so-called higher Bible critics believe that carbon was a primitive propitiation or appeasal of an angry God who wanted a part of what I had. And in the year 1876, the Reform leader Lilienthal said that he would strike from all bequeathed prayer books any line that reminds us of the temple or the sacrifices. That is just what Reform did, of course. Conservatives, incidentally, are more embarrassed. And as always, they're caught in the horns of a dilemma. It's part of a halacha, and at least formally, they still maintain some semblance of loyalty to halacha, so they have to have it. At the same time, it's embarrassing to the modern temperament to speak of animal sacrifice. So what do? They keep it in the Hebrew, but they don't translate it in the English. The second step was to keep it in the Hebrew, but instead of saying we will bring the sacrifices, they say we did bring it in the past. What this accomplishes, I still don't know, but at any rate, that is their dilemma. Now, what I'd like to do, I want to defend the institution of Karbanos from these attacks. I would like to try to show its positive meanings. I see a number of my colleagues in the audience. I beg of you, don't envy me now. I know I can hardly succeed. My goal is not to succeed. My goal, at the very best, friends, is to make you doubt your own doubts. And if I've done that, dayenu. One attack said that the whole sacrificial order was anthropopathic. It's such a big word, you don't like it already. It means that it is primitive because it began because it conceived of God as a human being in his feelings, like anthropos, a man, in his pathos, anthropopathic. It envisioned God as a God who likes to smell, and a God who is pleased, and a God who is angry, depending on whether you're going to give him a sacrifice. So the sacrifice, according to this school of anthropologists, was a primitive pagan rite which conceived of the God as having material needs. The God was hungry. The poor God had to be fed. We wouldn't want to be guilty of having undernourished gods. And therefore, we brought sacrifices to the gods. But this is nonsensical. It was untrue even about the most primitive pagan, for the simple reason that anyone who studies the manner in which a sacrifice was brought knows that the meat wasn't brought onto the Mizbeach as the main part. The main aspect was the sprinkling of the blood on the ground, where the god couldn't even drink it, even in one's imagination. So it couldn't mean that even for them, and therefore it just doesn't make too much sense. Besides, the Torah certainly has nothing even remotely resembling it. In the Torah, there are no promises in return for bringing a carbon. There are no ways, or the carbon is no way, to win favors and influence God. It is no economic principle of the exchange of gifts. The carbon in Judaism is an observance and not a bargain. It is a mitzvah and not a bribe. Then the second objection is the aesthetic one. It's primitive. Now, in many ways, this is the real nub of the question. This is the real reason that people choke, if they do, on trying to digest and accept the whole system of Karbanos. The real modernist objection is an aesthetic one. And yet, intellectually, it's the least potent of all. What does the modernist say? Why must you be so cruel to animals? Is that the way you serve God? By a barbaric slaughter of innocent animals? Well, that's a good argument. Frankly, I have some inside dope to the animal kingdom, and I have been told by my informants that animals have no special preference for being killed for the human stomach over being killed for the human soul. The late Franz Rosenzweig, the great German Jewish thinker, once said, "The horror at the slaughter of innocent animals sounds comical rather than serious on the lips of confirmed non-vegetarians." Now, I'm behind in my statistics, but I found only one. In 1959, the Department of Agriculture showed that the average American eats in that one year 158.1 pounds of red meat and 29.8 pounds of chicken, which means for that year a total of 188 pounds of meat. In 70 years, the average American consumes 13,000 pounds of meat. Well, with that almost ton of meat under our belts, it may not be the most appropriate thing to argue the cruelty of animals as a form of service. It just doesn't go. It just doesn't go. It may offend our aesthetics. Quite correct, I agree. But the argument of cruelty doesn't hold. In order to make it consistent, we have got to become vegetarians. Now, I agree that aesthetics is important, but it is not important than a mitzvah, not more important than a commandment. I'll give you an example. There are some Jews who believe that you have to come to a shul looking presentable. I couldn't agree more. But if you have 2 days yontif followed by a Shabbos, and on Shabbos you find Jews coming clean-shaven to shul, I say that that kind of aesthetics is wrong. It's the violation of the Torah. Come with a good thick beard, because there are times when aesthetics is not the most important thing. Appearances are not more important than inward commitments. So I agree it's not aesthetic. It doesn't look nice. I myself don't feel comfortable. But in our scale of values, there is a higher level and a lower level. And aesthetics is not the most important. Besides, please remember that at the time of the bringing of a carbon, this wasn't a cruel kind of bloodletting where people got together and gaulishly gathered around a poor animal and tortured it to death. Chas v'sholom. The slaughtering was quick, as it always is, and the Levium were singing, and what were they singing? The most beautiful hymns known to mankind, namely, what hymns were sung at the time of the carbon? The Tillim, the Psalms. So we ought not to let ephemeral taste dictate spiritual demands. Then there is an ethical argument. One of the carbonas that we bring is a sin offering. If a man commits a sin, he brings a carbon. It's an expiation. The argument then is that this is hypocritical, because it means if I sin, I can bring a sacrifice, and then what do? I sin all over again. That's a good argument, isn't it? Isn't it? Of course not. Why not? Because the carbon chatas could be brought only for a sin which I performed unwittingly. If I went and I knowingly violated the Shabbos, could I bring a carbon? No, absolutely not. If I forgot that it's Shabbos and I violated it, if I forgot that it was Yom Kippur and I ate, if I really forgot, then I could bring a carbon. Because I felt the weight of guilt, I could bring a carbon. If I did it deliberately, I can do tshuva. But a carbon no longer helps me. Furthermore, if you'll check in Vayikra, Perek Hey, I don't want to read it, it's a lengthy passage, that the carbon usually comes for sins against God. When there are sins against man, then the carbon can be brought only when? After you have made restitution and paid back what you've taken. And after what else? After restitution and after conciliation, when you've asked them to forgive you. Then and only then could you bring the carbon chatas. So not only was it ethical, but at the time of the bringing of the carbon, you had to say the vidui, you had to recite the confession. Now, there are those who point to the prophets as being opposed to the sacrifices. This, too, is not much of an argument. The prophets, it is true, fulminated against bringing sacrifices. But what they meant is against hypocrisy. They complain that if you bring a sacrifice, but you're unethical to your business employees, or you're unethical to your brother or to your neighbor, then the sacrifices have no value. Proof of the fact is that the same prophets, the same Isaiah, when he says to the Jews in the name of God, who needs your many sacrifices? What else does he say? Who needs your Shabbos, and who needs your Yontif or your Chodesh, and who needs your prayers? Does it mean that Isaiah was against prayer? No. It was Isaiah who said that in the future about the Beis HaMikdash, Ki Beisi Beis Tfilah Yikarei L'chol HaAmim, that my house will be called a house of prayer for all the peoples. It is Isaiah who said that in the days to come, the Kol Shomer Shabbos Mechalalo, we should observe the Sabbath and have compassion for the eunuch and pity for the stranger and observe Shabbos and the holidays and their and the stranger's korban should be acceptable. So that when they complained about sacrifices, they complained about a misemphasis. Let me give you an example. We Jews, who are understanding Jews, frequently are upset by what we call gastronomic Judaism. Isn't that right? We are upset with people whose all of Judaism lies in the gefilte fish or in the cholent. This is not Judaism. Do you agree with me that it's wrong? Yes? It's wrong, this gastronomic Judaism. All of our Judaism should be put into food. Is it right? All right. How many of those who think that it's wrong to be gastronomically Jewish are willing to give up their kugel next Shabbos? Simply is irrelevant. The fact that certain people stupidly emphasize an irrelevance as their Judaism doesn't mean you have to do away with it. Or, how many times have I preached against philanthropic Judaism? Against Jews who are Jews only because they give charity, otherwise have no connection with Judaism. I'm sure you'll agree with me. It's wrong. Does it mean I'm against giving charity? Many of you know from personal experience that it's not so. I know you often enough. Of course not. All of us have to give charity. What the prophet said was not that they were against sacrifices, but they are against putting all of Yiddishkeit into the sacrifice and assuming that there are no other obligations. Well, I want to go to two or three more explanations and we'll be done. One of the most important ones is the Rambam. Maimonides had said in the Guide for the Perplexed, when he tried to explain sacrifice, he said the following. Why did God give us a system of korbanos? Because in ancient days, the primitive pagans of Egypt and the Kasdim, the Chaldeans, used to bring sacrifices to the pagan gods, to the Se'idim, the spirits, the evil spirits in the desert, the goats, these spirits. And therefore, because Jews were affected by it, the Torah wanted to wean us away from this superstitious idolatry. So the Torah said, offer up a korban not to the evil spirit, but to the Rabbanu Shalom. Therefore, what do modernists conclude? In that case, they say, that was true for a generation which could have been tempted into offering a korban to an evil spirit. But we have no such problems. Have you ever offered a korban to an evil spirit? No. Therefore, we have no business with sacrifices. Is that valid, that argument? You guessed. Ramban dismisses the whole argument for his own reasons. And he's right, you know. He said that Cain and Abel brought sacrifices. There were no Egyptians or Chaldeans around in those days. Maimonides himself codifies as law that there will be sacrifices. About a fifth or a sixth of his whole Mishnah Torah deals with the sanctuary, the temple, and with the sacrificial order. And Maimonides was not a controlled schizophrenic. He was one personality. What did he mean then? He meant something very simple. He meant that at one point in history, God revealed himself to the Jews. And when he did so, he gave them laws. Why did he give them specific laws? He says there may have been historical reasons. And they're interesting, but they have nothing to do with our observance. The Rambam gives reasons why meat and milk are forbidden. It has to do with ancient pagans. Why a Jew cannot cut off his hair straight, he has to leave a peah as we have it. Ancient reasons. Does it mean that because we are no longer tempted by the ancient pagans, that therefore we ought not to observe milchiks and fleishiks? We ought not to refrain from eating karfis? Of course not. This is all of Jewish law. What Maimonides therefore meant was to look for an anthropological explanation, but it does not control our practice. I'll give you another example. Maimonides says that the most important thing, not Maimonides, all of Judaism, what is the most important aspect of prayer? The words that I say? The motions of my mouth? No, what then? Kavana, my intentions. Maimonides says that a prophet should arise and say to us, do away with prayer. All I want of you is your intention. That prophet is a Navi Sheker. He is a false prophet. because Jewish law strikes a balance between inwardness and the ceremonial. There can be no inwardness unless there is expression outward. We have to have both. Even if the inward is more important, it does not mean we can do away with the other part. Finally, and I'm skipping parts, the symbolic explanation offered by Samson Raphael Hirsch and a disciple, the late and revered Rabbi David Zvi Huffman. It's a whole symbolic system, but one thing is most important. Huffman points to one of the first two sacrifices we know of in Jewish history, in history. Cain and Abel, right? The both of them brought sacrifices. Now, which was accepted and which was rejected? Cain's was rejected, Abel's was accepted. Huffman says as follows. When Cain brought his sacrifice, he had a certain idea. His idea was that God is a tyrant. He's the boss man over the world. Kind of How Green Was My Valley, is that the name of the famous show? How Green Was My Valley conception, a primitive conception. God is the strong man. I have got to conciliate him. I have got to appease him. Therefore, what do I do to God? Says Cain. I say, God, here's your share. This is the payola. This is the payoff. I have given you your share. Now don't bother me. Everything else belongs to whom? To me.